Well, welcome to day 5 of the World Athletics Championships, our podcast Inside Lane, here with Dr. Ross Tucker. And we've been part of this podcast since last week, Tuesday, when we did our first podcast previewing these World Championships. And we've been live every single day on Facebook Live and Runners World, as you are with us at the moment. Don't forget, a bit later on, if you are listening to us and you can't listen to the entire podcast on Facebook, you can download the audio version a bit later on from our website. And so don't forget, you can also tweet us. Ross is at Science of Sport on Twitter, and there's been a lot of interaction on his Twitter in particularly. And a big thank you to everybody that's sent us some questions and given us their views about what's happening at the World Championships. So a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk a little bit about what happened last night in the women's 1500 meters, one of the most dramatic events of the championship so far. Who knows what's still to come? We're going to talk a little bit about a bit of a gastro problem that's going on with some of the athletes in the village that could affect Botswana and Botswana's chance of really making history at these World Championships. And then we'll talk about the finals tonight. And I'm not going to beat around the bush here. Tonight is my favorite night of the whole championships, purely because two of my favorite events are on tonight: the men's 800 meters, which is tactics and skill and everything that goes into that event, personified for track and field, and the men's 3000 meter steeplechase, which is, you know, if you don't love the steeplechase, you probably don't love athletics. It's a beautiful event to watch, and I'm sure we're sure that the Kenyans are normally going to win, but we might have a caveat to that a bit later on. So, Ross, let's talk a bit about that 1500 meters last night. Eventually won by Faith Kipyego from Kenya. But when we talked about this yesterday, it was a fairly open race. The Semenya sort of figure there was going to be critical to how that race was run. Just to take us through some of the stats around it and how it sort of played out last night.
It was one of the greatest middle distance races I've ever seen. I thought it was.
Yeah.
I mean, there was so much suspense, and we did. We told you it would be one of the highlights of this week, and it lived up to that. Because when you've got three or four good athletes, it's going to be good. But in this race, you had six, so any one of six athletes could have won this, or would have shared the medals. There were big unknowns: how good would Semenya be in a fast race, and so on. And it just, from the time that gun went off, you just waited and waited and waited for something to explode. And Once Hassan went, so it didn't go the way that we thought it would. Although we did discuss the big game of poker that these athletes would play. So maybe that's the first thing to say, is you've got such a competitive group of six athletes, right? Someone is going to take a risk to lead, because when you go to the front, you're doing work on behalf of other people. So some of that involves overcoming wind resistance, but it's not quite like cycling. Most of it is psychological and emotional. You're the rabbit and they are chasing you. And when they are so close to you in performance level, you are taking a risk with your own race to do it. And so that's why no one does it.
So why is it easier for somebody to be following somebody else? As you say, it's not like cycling, very little effort and very little to do with wind resistance.
Some. But not much, no.
When you talk about the psychological effect of being able to be behind somebody, what do you mean by that? Why is it slightly easier?
I think because you don't have to worry about the pace. All you got to do is worry about staying a meter from their vest. And then it allows you to control the race. Because it can allow you to control the race if you are comfortable enough sitting on them. Because now you're just going to let them do all the work. With 200 to go, 100 to go, whenever you decide, you can make your move, and then they've got to respond to you. So I think it's mostly a mental, psychological and emotional thing that it takes off of you. So that's why so few people are willing to do it in these big championship races. And that's why they pay athletes money to do it in Diamond League events. It's because you just send the person out there, they're the rabbit, like a greyhound chasing a rabbit on a track, and that's how it's set up. So yesterday we saw no one willing to do it.
Just to take a step back just on that last comment. It is interesting that at World Championship level, it's a very different race from the races you get at Diamond League and places like the Weltklasse, the big sort of commercial, if you can call it that, athletics meetings, because they pay for these pace setters. That's often why you get records at the big meetings like the Weltklasse as opposed to World Championships, where they don't have the pace setters.
Yeah, hardly ever see a distance world record. And it's why you get surprises, especially in the 1500, because that's the one event that's fast but tactical in the sense that you can go slowly for a couple laps, which is what we saw. So they go through 800 in 217, which is pedestrian. And you could have thrown a...
Went to, I think, the first 400 and 165.
Yeah, 65. Like, and then the second 400 was 70, 71.
Yeah.
Even slower.
Yeah, yeah. You could have stayed with him.
Barely. on that lap, maybe.
On a bike.
And so forget about a blanket. You could have thrown a bath towel over that group. They were so tightly congested and bunched. Now, when that's the situation, something's going to give.
Mm.
And that something with 650 to go was Hassan, who's the world number one this year and went into this probably as the favorite, having beaten all the rivals earlier this year. So with 650 to go, and again, this race will be on television or on the internet somewhere. Go and watch it and just have a look for some of these things, because there are such unbelievable, we're geeking out here, but there's such unbelievable little nuances in the story and the plot and the twists and what the characters are doing that it really brings out track and field.
Yeah.
More than any event that I've seen in a long time.
And we're celebrating this. I mean,
This is what we spoke about yesterday. This is what the sport needs. Yeah. So much intrigue and excitement.
Mm-hmm.
So Hassan goes from the back to the front within 70 meters with like something fierce, right? And you see, so this is the first point in the tech. You see the urgency from Kip Yegon, Muir and Simpson, not from Semenya. The moment that orange vest, because she goes right from the back to the front, the moment that orange vest comes past, that race is lit up.
Yeah.
And then she just keeps going, because now this is her play. Like, they know it's got to be aggressive, because Semenya, off another slow lap, is winning this event. So it's aggressive. So she runs from 600 out, she runs 30.3 for 200 meters. Then she gets faster, she runs 28.1 for the next 200. At the bell, they're all still together. By 200 to go, that field is strung out like a like an accordion. I mean, they are just boom.
And Semenya's already lost a lot of,
and Semenya's in gap. Yeah. And Semenya's in eighth.
Yeah.
So that's a mistake.
Yeah.
Because that's not a nobody doing that work at the front. That's the favorite. And again, Kip Yegon and Muir and Simpson were so quick to get onto her when she went.
Yeah.
And Semenya was lying in about eighth, and she ended up in 12th. At the moment that Hassan made the move, she just wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
Tactically, she was very poor. She was absent in that race, in my opinion.
Mm.
And it was only because she's got such finishing ability that she was able to come back. But let's go back. So 200 to go. You've got Hassan and Kip Yegon hunted down by Muir and Simpson, and then another 5-10 meters behind them is Semenya. And now it's last 200. And that's where Hassan pays, because you said yesterday that Sepeng had told you that 800 is like spending a budget. And the problem Hassan had yesterday is that she spent her budget a week before the end of the month. And so she blew her salary in the 400 meters before the last 200, you know. And so in the last 200, she held on for dear life. But with 50 to go, she's now begging.
But when you see those finishing boards, I mean, she's still in second with the finishing boards like lining up, and you think, I mean, it would have been a famous medal for her if she'd hang on. I mean, she wasn't that far away from actually putting off an amazing coup.
She was courageous, and she's a quality athlete.
Yeah.
So she nearly did it, but she goes, as I say, 30.3, 28.1, 31.5. And so the last 200 is the slowest of her last six, but the damage was done in the last 50, because, you know, it's like if it's about spending money, physiology always collects its debt. And so she's deeply in debt with 50 to go, and then she pays it back. So then she goes from second to fifth in no time at all. And Simpson's passing her, Muir's passing her, and Semenya's getting her. Kip Yegon, meanwhile, tactically has been everyone who took the lead in that race. And again, watch that. Muir goes to the lead, Kip Yegon's on his shoulder. Hassan goes, first person's Kip Yegon. When Kip Yegon makes that super aggressive move at the bell, Kip Yegon's on her. So tactically she's right on it, but physiologically she's also the only person who could pull it off, and that's why she won it. And then behind them you've got a host of athletes who are doing different things tactically. So Laura Muir and Jenny Simpson are really good to compare, because with 250 to go, and I've got pictures of this, by the way. So if you want to see this,
Let's just clarify. Laura Muir is the British athlete.
She's the British hope in her home stadium.
And she really is one of the top stars of the British track and field team.
Fastest in the world last year.
Yeah. So. And they've got the American Simpson, who is well known as a fast finisher.
Yeah.
But kind of an outsider in that scenario.
By time.
Yeah.
But in a tactical race, the smartest middle distance runner in the world.
Yeah.
Like, I think. And she proved it
yesterday. Although she was lucky. Hassan definitely left a gap on the inside.
A little bit. Although I was thinking about that. I think it's still a percentage play to be on the inside with 120 to go, because that gap, I think, more often than not opens up and you're still running the shorter line. So you're right, she benefited, but she was there to benefit.
Because the sun just drifted across from the inside lane into the second lane. Because
so she passed her in lane one.
Yeah.
So they're instructive to compare. And again, there are, I've put pictures of screenshots on my Twitter account. So if you want to see it, you can. With 250 to go, they are next to one another. And with 200 to go, Muir's 3 meters ahead of Simpson. Because Muir makes her big play from 250 to 100 to go. So she's got these two leaders off in front of her, and she's like, I've got to close this gap. And so she makes a big move there and finds also with 50 to go, she doesn't quite have it.
Yeah.
Simpson, on the other hand, is a little bit more patient. I think she understands her limits a little bit better. That's part of tactics, is knowing. You have to be plugged in to what's your capacity, what's your strength, what's your weakness. And you can imagine with 250 to go, you've got Kipyegon and Hassan going hell for leather at the front.
Yeah.
And then Muir leaves you behind. Yeah. So that's the medals disappearing.
Yeah.
And the discipline and the control and the emotional control to say, I'm happy at this pace. That's impressive. Mm. So where Hassan does 28.1, Simpson does 28.9 for that 200. But then she still finishes in 29.5 and Hassan's slowing down. So that's where she catches her. So just patience and control.
It was a great bit of footage that we saw in the broadcast last night where you see Simpson looking down at Hassan at one stage. She kind of sees that there's potentially a gap happening up in the inside, knows that's the chance that she has, but she's watching the pace of Hassan. I mean, she realizes that Hassan's kind of coming back towards her. Suddenly there's this kind of, you know, I can't really call it a glint in her eye, but there's this, oh, goodness me, I've got a chance here. And then she just goes for it. So it was almost like she was waiting. She got the gap and thought, this is just a great bit of luck. And I've timed this perfectly. Because there is luck involved to some extent. It's not all just about, you know, you being in the right place at the right time.
Well, there's luck because you're not solely responsible for your own fate.
Yeah.
There are other people who are doing things. That's why it's poker, because you've got your hand, but so do they. And so,
Because you were saying that Simpson, in terms of tactics last night, got an A+, and Semenya got a D-. Is it as clear as that?
For me, I think so.
I think so.
If you're Semenya, you cannot let a gap of 10 to 15 meters go from the bell to 200, because at the bell, as I said, when Hassan goes to the front, Kipyegon, Simpson, Muir are so quick to go with it. Watch it again. It's just it's like a bomb goes off in that group.
Incredible.
And Semenya is the only one who doesn't go. And so she goes, as I said, from 8th at that moment, she drifts right back to 12th. And
I think that's confidence, arrogance.
I don't know.
Just tactical.
She just looked inattentive.
Because she always looks like that, though, to some extent. She always looks like she's jogging and just kind of running around.
I can't tell what the plan was. Because if I'm coaching her, or anyone, in fact, if I'm coaching anyone in a women's 1500, I'm going to say, that woman in the American vest with Simpson on the bib, stay behind her and run the last 300 5 meters faster than her, and you'll win the race. Guaranteed.
And so
it's not even a complicated tactical scenario. You just got to sit on the on your rival. Anyway, with 400 to go, Semenya was still there, and I still thought watching it that she could do this.
Yeah.
But with 250 to go, her race is done. Because in those 150, she's lost another 7 or 8 meters. Now, at the bell, that's like, any runner knows, the bell's like switch on. She seemed to switch off.
Yeah.
And then she wanted to switch on at 200 to go. And as I say, she did the last 200 much faster than anyone else. And so to her credit, she comes back and she fights all the way to the line. And I think you said it, 0.007 seconds ahead of
0.07 seconds between her and Muir. I mean, she broke British hearts last night. There's no doubt about that.
And so, to her credit, like, good for her for fighting and winning that medal. But I just thought she tactically was inattentive at the two moments that she needed to be alert, and they were obvious moments. It's not like Hassan's move should have been a surprise, and the bell is never a surprise. I was actually a little bit disappointed in her tactical approach. I thought it was poor.
Brilliant race all round. We're going to touch very briefly on probably the biggest controversy in track and field over the last maybe 5 years, other than some of the doping scandals. But that is
the story.
This is even bigger. So many is
more complex.
The story of hyperandrogenism. It is something that is always going to be talked about, and we saw in some of the media today that the journalists were asking Laura Muir, who finished fourth behind Semenya, to kind of draw her into a reaction to this debate around Semenya. Let's, without getting into the debate, where are we with that, with Semenya? Where's the IAAF? And I know that you have your own thoughts, and let's just put this out right now. This is not a personal thing about Caster Semenya. No. As a South African, we're always massively supportive of her. It's sometimes just the science behind this, and that's what we need to look at to some extent.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike? There's more than science. There's sociology and culture and all kinds of history here, because the issue is almost 100 years old. You know, 1936 were the first cases of these athletes, and at the time they thought they were men disguising themselves as women to compete. And history has revealed that that's never happened. That happens in the Hollywood movies, not in reality. But so the initial fear of cheating was replaced by the fear that there are conditions. These are biological conditions where people have what's called the disorder of sex development or differentiation. So that's a person who is genetically male, but who, for various reasons, and there's a handful of these conditions, develops as physiologically, externally female. And ever since 2009, when an 18-year-old Semenya won the world title in Berlin, she has been the focal point for this discussion. Now, she's not the only athlete. We know of a handful of others. The research that has been done on this since 2009 has revealed double-digit numbers at world championships. So there are many more than just Semenya. But because of how that 2009 case was messed up by everyone, ASA, IAAF, the media, everyone, she's the magnet for it. And so every time she wins, there she comes up. Now, in Rio 2016, in the 800, it's pretty much thought of now that the top three there share the condition. And so they asked Lindsay Sharp, who'd come fifth or sixth, sorry for forgetting, what she thought of it, and she was tearful and upset because it was on the finish line, and she said a few things which I'm sure she wishes she could take back about how unfair it is and how difficult it is. And so now I think what's happened in Muir's response is that the authorities have said, listen, if anyone asks you about it, just say, I have nothing to say.
Yeah.
And so they've shut it down, which I sort of understand from the athlete's point of view, because that's not their domain.
Muir was quite upset about people asking her the question, actually, to her credit. She said, I don't really want to answer this question.
I'm not even showered, and I'm still sweating and disappointed.
The media.
So, you guys, hunting stories. But I think we do need to, not everyone, but there needs to be, I think, a lot more knowledge and sensitivity in the debate. Because when you go on websites and Facebook and so on, you'll see the comments in response, and people say, he's a man, she's a man, and people say Caster shouldn't be there, and they make all sorts of lewd jokes and crude jokes. Now that's not fair on a human level. On the other side is people saying, just leave it alone, and don't, like, who are you, what right do you have? And that's to me not right on a physiological, scientific level. And so there needs to be a little bit more meeting of minds. And there are people who I have tremendous respect for who disagree with me on this issue about what should be done about it, but we understand one another's position. So that's the best, I think for me that's the least I would ask for, is that people try and understand before they comment, you know. And this issue will come up again in the eight, because as I say, there's not one, but potentially three. And it's hell of a complex. So where are we? That's what you asked. In 2015... the Court of Arbitration for Sport heard a case brought by an Indian sprinter called Duti Chand, who was in London in the 100, didn't qualify for finals. And she was protesting the regulations that the athletics federations had put in place around these individuals. What that basically said after 2009 is that any woman who had one of these DSDs, an intersex condition, had to have a testosterone level below 10. And so they'd done a little bit of research and checking, and they'd figured that 10 would be an acceptable cutoff.
Right.
And so those athletes were then taking medicines to lower their testosterone.
What's an average? I mean, what would, if 10 is the maximum, what's the average?
At the World Champs 2011, good question, 99% of women were below 3.1.
Okay. And so that's quite a lot of leeway there.
So statistically, that's called the 99th percentile. So 1% of women are above 3.1,
right,
and they set the limit at 10. The right. average is about 2.5, 2.6.
Okay.
So in that regard, it looks generous, but the objection is, why do you force an athlete to take medicine to correct what's basically a natural condition? So that's the argument. Anyway, the Court of Arbitration hears the case in July 2015, and their decision is that there is insufficient scientific evidence to support what in that moment was a discriminatory policy.
Mm.
Why was it discriminatory? Because it only applies to women and not men. Okay. And so there's a subtlety of European law which governs the Court of Arbitration, which actually lost the IAAF this case. Because had they had a similar policy for men, it wouldn't have been discriminatory. But a discriminatory...
So it's almost a technicality to some extent.
To some extent, yeah. So because it's deemed discriminatory against women only, it needs to have strong evidence.
Mm.
And that evidence, the court decided, was lacking.
Mm.
They didn't scrap the law altogether.
Mm.
Instead, they said, you, the IAAF, are now next to one another.
Mm.
And with 200... That two-year period has ended now.
Mm.
And so the IAAF, in response to that, has gone off to try and find the evidence. And some of it's been published, so we know what's there. Some of it was published in February this year.
Mm.
Some of it was published 3 weeks ago, a month ago.
Mm. Why did the IAAF want to get this through? I mean, why do they want it? It almost seems slightly counterproductive from their side.
So for them, their argument is fairness and equality of the sport.
Mm.
So the fundamental question here...
With Cassius Semenya, we hope we've kind of clarified where we are with this and taking the emotion out of it. I think that's often the problem. You know, how do you do something that is so emotional and people get on both sides of it very, very hyped up about it? We don't want to run too much out of time today, but let's just briefly go through some of one of the events that was a highlight last night, the men's 110 meter hurdle final. Our big favourite didn't win, Merritt, the American who had a kidney transplant, and suddenly he didn't do so well last night, but still a fascinating race.
Yeah, Merritt missed the podium, which meant for the first time, I saw a tweet yesterday by David Oliver, who himself has won medals at World and Olympics. First time in over 100 years that the US has not been a medalist in that 110 hurdles. They've owned that event, and now they don't have a podium. So so that's a end of something for them.
And a great name for a winner, Aries Merritt, if he had one, isn't it? I mean, he's got the perfect name to be a...
You're obviously a fan of Merritt.
I am a bit
his
of a fan.
His hair, his
I
name,
like good stories.
You like good stories. Anyway, he didn't win it. It was won instead by Omar McLeod, fairly comfortably too. So that's Jamaica on the board as far as golds goes.
And probably one of the best celebrations of a gold medal I saw. His mom was praying for him as he finished, and then he was on the floor. It was almost like some sort of religious ceremony that was going on. He was really, really into it.
Yeah.
Lovely to see.
Yeah, so he beat Shubenkov and Hungarian Bargy, I think, for third. So a non-US podium, I think, was as big a story there as a Jamaican winner.
And Shubenkov, of course, running for...
Not Russia. Yeah, he's running under the flag of the approved athletes from Russia. But his country obviously not there.
Yeah,
so that was the other gold medal awarded last night on the track, and then there was a hell of a triple jump competition as well. I don't know if you saw much of that. But that was something else. I mean, the field events often are quite tricky, but that was quality.
Yeah.
That was a superb competition.
And great personalities in that women's triple jump. I mean,
they were getting
the crowd going, and it was great. It was great entertainment, beyond just track and field.
That was a treat. Yeah, it was really good.
Absolutely. Mm. One of the stories that's been doing the rounds is that there's been this gastroenteritis outbreak, and it's affected some of the top athletes, including Botswana's Isaac Makwala, who was a big contender for a medal in the 400 meters. And I think more importantly, and maybe on a global level, Botswana were one of the middle favourites for the 4x4, which is obviously in doubt now. You know, I mean, think Botswana.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little country down here in the southern part of Africa, taking potentially the gold medal in the 4x4 if things had worked out for them.
Yeah.
But what do you know about this? I mean, there's some conflicting information about this gastro outbreak.
There's the usual fog of war, you know. So Thomas Barr from Ireland is a 400 hurdler, came fourth in the Olympics, and he was the first name I saw who said he's pulling out of the semis last night. And then Makwala didn't start the 200 heat, and that was the first indication, because apparently he'd been on the warm-up track. And so everyone's like, okay, the guy's obviously running, and then next thing he didn't show for the race. And the story is that the doctor at the event had recommended or told him that he shouldn't be running the 200. And because he's got the second fastest time in the world this year over four, and he's probably a big favorite to win a medal, I don't think gold even before this, but he's a medal likelihood, he maybe decided out of the 200. Now he's in a race against time to be fit for tonight, because that 400 final is tonight's last event. Yeah. So is he going to recover or not? We don't know. But anyway, then Michael Johnson tweeted that Elaine Thompson of Jamaica has also got the same issue, this gastro problem, food poisoning, he called it, and blamed it on the hotel that they were all staying at.
I suppose the conspiracy theorists are going crazy. Now
it's an epidemiological conspiracy.
Somebody's poisoning the athletes.
Yeah. So then eventually on Twitter, a guy called Stuart McMillan, who coaches André de Grasse of Canada, messaged me on Twitter to say, actually, they're not in the same hotel. It's Botswana, Canada, and Germany are, but the Jamaicans are elsewhere. So it doesn't seem like one hotel is the source of this particular epidemic. But the story coming out of London was that five athletes were hospitalized and seven in total had to withdraw or pull out in some way or affected in their races. So that sucks. I mean, imagine for Mukwala, I mean, it's a massive blow, because he wasn't just a medal chance in the four. He was a chance in the two, fastest in the world this year, plus that 4x4, which you mentioned. And for Botswana, Nigel Amos goes in the eight tonight. They could have had two medals tonight.
Yeah.
Maybe three, because they've got another guy in the 400 who is running from lane nine, so he's up against it a little bit.
Yeah.
But they could have had three medals tonight, plus that relay, and now, it's a pity. Yeah. It's a shame.
Well, talking about tonight, let's run through some of the finals tonight. And as we said at the beginning of our podcast, my two favorite events, the 3,000-meter steeplechase and the 800-meter final tonight as well. But from a South African perspective, we're very excited about Wade van Niekerk and the 400 meters. But let's just start with the steeplechase very quickly. Maybe a Kenyan won't win. Surely that is not true.
At this stage, there is more chance that a Kenyan won't get a medal.
Okay.
Than the fact that a Kenyan will win.
I think we'd ever heard that when it comes to
steeplechase. Yeah, it's unheard of. You know, since 1991 was the first Kenyan ever winner in a steeplechase race, or medalist. There have been 19 majors since that point, so that's 57 medals. Kenya's got 42 of them, and only twice have they not won it. And the two that they didn't win was a Kenyan-born man competing for Qatar.
Yeah.
Shaheen, right? So he changed nationality. So in actual fact, out of 19 world and Olympic champs, since 1991, a Kenyan-born man has won every single one.
Okay.
And that could end tonight, because...
Who are we looking at?
The favorite would be Yeager of the USA.
Okay.
He's the fastest in the world this year by 3 seconds. He won a super fast race in Monaco a couple of weeks ago, which was the last one coming into these championships. He's beaten everyone in this field, and he looks like he can win it any way he needs to. You know, whether it's fast at the beginning... or fast at the end, he seems to have everything it takes. And the big thing in his favor is that the depth of the Kenyans is nowhere where it used to be, and their best guy has been injured. So Conseslus Kipruto is the Kenyan champion and the defending Olympic champion, and he has been affected by an injury ever since those Kenyan champs. And so he raced the last two events in Monaco and I think one before it in Rabat, and didn't finish either.
Yeah.
So is he healthy? Doesn't seem he is, you know. So Jaeger's
just mind blowing to think that
so, this. Yeah, so Jaeger's biggest rival is likely to be the Moroccan Al Bakali. And the other Kenyan, so it's Kipruto and then Ezekiel Kemboi, basically retired after Rio, and then we spoke the other day, he got disqualified and lost his bronze medal.
Yeah.
And then
stepping out of the lane.
Stepping off his lane. And then announced his comeback to come and win the medal that he deserved. But he's been really nowhere all year. And then the last one's Berich, who just doesn't seem to be good in these championships. So the three Kenyans look more vulnerable than ever before. And if I had to guess, I would say it's going to be Jaeger, Bakali, and then maybe a Kenyan, but perhaps the French, Benabad, someone else from Iraq. It's wide open.
Yeah.
If Kipruto is healthy, then for sure he's a challenger to Jaeger. But if I was betting your house this time, I would be betting it on Jaeger, and that, as we said, will be historical. So that's something to look out for. It's never happened
tonight. Before. If you got the kids, make sure they're in bed nice and early, because you want to be sitting down with your cup of hot chocolate and making sure that you're watching these finals. Very briefly, the 800 meter final, wide open, as we discussed the other day, the semifinals, six of the top nine in the world out. Suddenly there's a race on for somebody, you know, an outsider at the start of these championships to win the medals.
Not a single medalist from Rio is in this race. Three of the top nine are in this race in the world. The other six all got eliminated in the heat. So it is as open as any race. And the 800 is always a little bit random because, as we said yesterday in yesterday's podcast, there's 105 seconds in that race, and if you make a mistake over one of them, then you find yourself going from really good to a really bad position, and that is too quick to recover. So Nigel Amos, who we mentioned from Botswana a few moments ago, is the fastest in the world this year in that race, and so physically probably is your best bet.
Yeah,
but because of the tactics, it's you look quite poor tactically in the semi, and he has been known to mess up these championship events before. So it's going to be really interesting. Like, it's the same issues you had in the women's 15. Who takes it up?
And with no clear favorite, there's nobody necessarily to see as a threat. So everybody's going to be watching everybody else.
So there's eight guys there, and they all fancy their medal chances. Whereas normally you're not going to get it as open as that because anyone could do it. So in the semis, there's a 19-year-old Kenyan in the race called Kipyegon Bett. And he took the pace in his semi and led basically start to finish. And in another semi, there's a Canadian called McBride who did the same thing. So one of those two likely will do the same thing. It worked for them. And then it's a question of how quickly do they go, and what does that do to everyone behind them? Because with 250 to go, there's going to be a traffic jam.
Yeah.
And they're going to be queuing up. And that's where you look for the same kinds of things we've mentioned in that 1500. And there's a Polish guy called Adam Kaszot who... My impressions watching him is that tactically he's the most switched on. Got really good finishing speed. So
I think he won his semi, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
So for me, Kaszot, Amos, and then toss a six-sided coin to find the other medalist. But I wouldn't
want... We're not putting any money on anybody.
No, I wouldn't. So all I'll say is Kaszot and Amos get medals. But then the third medal and the order in which they finish, that's we'll tell you tomorrow morning after the race.
Last one, the 400-meter final. Obviously, for us South Africans, was something very close to our heart. Wade van Niekerk, the world champion, the world record holder, the world and the Olympic champion, looked brilliant in the 200 last night. Looked very comfortable. He's obviously the odds-on favourite, but it's not a fait accompli here at all. He's certainly up against it, trying to do the double.
No, well, if Makwala is still affected by the bug, then van Niekerk's job got easier for sure. But he's starting this race in lane 6. You might remember in Rio he won it from 8, running blind the whole way. He doesn't have to do that this time.
Yeah.
That's going to be the Botswana's champion, Tebi, I think is his name. He's doing the running blind challenge tonight.
Just very briefly, let's just talk about the lane differences. So if you're in the outside lane, because of the stagger, you don't see anybody in the race. You've literally got to run a time trial by yourself and then hope by the time you get to the finishing straight, you're somewhere in the mix.
Yeah.
If you're in the middle lane, you can see your competitors, and ideally what you want is lane 5 with your main competitor in lane 6 that
you're
in.
Because if you're one lane inside your main guy, then it depends on your plan. Maybe you want to close him up at 200 and remind him that you're there. Maybe you want to just keep it there and beat him in the last 200. So you've got options. Whereas if you're in lane 8, your options are limited because...
So for Niekerk, not an ideal lane for him, though, in all honesty.
So the guy he's got to key off is Makwala, so that's good. 6 and 7 is Makwala, so he can run it off Makwala. But the guy who looked the best in the semis was Stephen Gardner from the Bahamas, who is just, I mean, he's long and everything about Stephen Gardner.
Is that how they call the boy wonder?
I'm not sure.
I think it is. I don't know. But anyway.
But he ran under 44 second in the semi, which is very rarely done. And so he's in lane 4 or 5, I think. I think 4. And then there's a Jamaican in lane. Alan is in lane 6, 5, and then for Niekerk 6. So he won't see Gardner, who I suspect, now that McQuarrie is affected, is going to be his big challenge. But I don't... Yeah, I can't see that affecting him. I think he's so superior that for Niekerk tonight runs 43.2 to 43.4, and as a result wins it by 0.3 of a second. Even if everyone else in that race shoots the lights out, for Niekerk still beats them by 5 meters, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, I can't see that one going against the script.
So it's a night that is happening at 10 to 10 in the UK, and if you're in South Africa, it'll be 10 to 11, so we'll be definitely staying up for that. So lots of excitement. So Ross, thanks so much for your time again today. Don't forget, tomorrow we'll be live with our podcast or video cast on Facebook. Please don't hesitate in asking us some questions. You can tweet us. You can tweet Ross at Science or Sport as well, and of course, Runners World South Africa. We look forward to a great evening of athletics, and we look forward to breaking it all down tomorrow, and looking forward to the finals tomorrow night. Thanks so much for your time.